When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Books podcast with me, Sian Kane.
And me, Claire Armistead.
This week, we speak to Tom Mole about the history of the book itself.
Now, I heard a story once about a professor who came into class with a collected works of Shakespeare, and then he ripped it up and threw the pages around. The class were appalled. They gasped. They couldn't believe that he was doing this. And so that shows how much our reverence for authors, for literature, for words, for stories, for ideas, gets transferred onto the material form in which those words and ideas circulate.
And we reflect on the most ancient long poem known to exist, Gilgamesh, with poet and publisher Michael Schmidt. But first, Sunday saw the announcement of the Forward Prizes for Poetry at a glitzy evening of readings on London's South Bank. Let's listen in to some of it.
And the winner of the Felix Dennis Prize for Best First Collection of 2019 is Stephen Sexton.
May this unhaunted house be yours, and may it be happy and bright. May the creak in the rafters be a sparrow returning to nest after all these years, and before the many more I step aside. And if you find someday, dear friend, my sad head upon your shoulders, go out into the world. Say, world, it's been so long. Say, world, hello.
The winner of the Forward Prize for Best Collection 2019 is no stranger to the Forward stage, Fiona Benson.
It's hard to explain. Let me show you with the anatomical dolls. They have buttons for eyes and details under their pants you wouldn't believe. Look underneath at the girl's folded labia, vagina, the tucked-in silk and string umbilical of a pull-down poppet fetus, or the male's miniature penis, his cotton bag scrotum, his sphincter ringed in little puckered stitches. So the girl doll took off her frilly knickers, and the boy doll pushed down his trousers and did this. And you might think it was love, if you hadn't seen Act One, the male doll playing punch, Judy trembling and bruised, her bloody nose. Tell me what's the word for this, this spreading of the legs and lips to delay violence. And where's the rough music? All my charivari pots and wooden spoons to out you, Zeus, to drive you through the streets with songs that find a name for you at last, you filthy pimp, you animal, you rapist.
We don't often cover poetry on this podcast, but the two occasions when it sort of bursts out and it is impossible to ignore in the UK are on the occasion of the Forward Prizes and the T.S. Eliot Prizes. And in both cases, they take place on London's South Bank. And I think that we're looking at the moment, we're looking for poets to come up with some sort of an answer to our really troubled, difficult, technologically shifting and morally shifting times. And that's precisely what these prizes have done, in all sorts of interesting ways, which you see in these two winners, the big two winners of the evening. The winner of the first collection, the Felix Dennis Prize, was Stephen Sexton, who's a Northern Irish poet, who goes back to his obsession with Super Mario when he was a kid. And he said he wanted to go through all the levels of Super Mario, but he maps that onto the geography of Ireland. And Ireland is this donut concept in Super Mario, Northern Ireland is a donut in that it has lots of missing bits. And that in turn maps back to his childhood and the fact that he's just lost his mother. So it's sort of personal and geographical and also past and present. But the biggest winner of the evening is Fiona Benson, and it's only her second collection actually that she's won with, called Vertigo and Ghost, and it's in two sections. And the first recasts Zeus as a predatory swimming coach. You have him sort of stripping off to a minuscule red speedo and bulges profanely. very visual. It's basically the series of rapes he carried out, and the voiceless on all these voiceless women, and how there could possibly be any sort of retribution. And obviously, it maps very clearly onto the Harvey Weinstein and Me Too movement. And then in the second section, she goes back to the terrain which is familiar from her debut collection, Bright Travellers, from 2014. Which is about motherhood and miscarriage and the traumas of being a woman in the modern world. But there are all sorts of fascinating correspondences between these two eras. For example, Zeus is most commonly represented as a bull. And in the second half, you have a flood has been strung up on a tree by sudden floodwaters. She goes past and just sees this bull carcass hanging from a tree. And so in something like that, that's both an anecdote about seeing a bull in a tree, but it's also, you say, is that about the death of old mythological frameworks? You know, there's this bull which the flies are eating. And most shockingly of all, in a poem which is sort of a very homely poem, really, about going into a changing room with her child to change her child out of her swimming costumes, she says, "We're not meant to write of the shower, we who were not there, but on mad days it's all I can think of." So she's daring to invoke the Holocaust in these stories of being a woman in the modern era and being a mother. And you know, you just realise actually that relates back to the idea of the audacity of the Greeks, and they told such huge stories, but it was owned by men. Mm-hmm. And here she is as a mother in a normal life, owning these really horrific, overwhelming stories.
Well, just a few days ago, it was announced that Fiona Benson is also up for the T.S. Eliot Prize with Vertigo and Ghost. So good luck to her. Maybe she'll get both. The Forward Prizes for Poetry ceremony is part of the South Bank Centre's Poetry International Festival, which was set up by Ted Hughes in 1967. The ceremony takes place each year in South Bank Centre's Queen Elizabeth Hall. Tom Moll is Professor of English Literature and Book History at the University of Edinburgh and Director of the Centre for the History of the Book. In his new work, The Secret Life of Books: Why They Are So Much More Than Just Words, Tom looks at books as physical objects and how our experience of reading has changed through time. Could modern technologies transform the ways in which we read our favourite stories? Can you claim to have read a book if you've only listened to the audio version of it? Richard spoke with him to find out.
Books are gateways to other worlds. They're creations of the mind which can remove us from the messy business of the physical realm. But they're objects as well, aren't they? When did it first strike you that the book that you were reading was also just made of stuff?
That's right. I think books are living this kind of double life. And we often think of them as just like containers for words, vehicles for information, for entertainment. But they're also things. And I remember very vividly when I was an undergraduate trying to read Middlemarch and being halfway through the book and suddenly noticing that I was sure I'd read this before. I realized that there was a whole section of pages that had been duplicated and a corresponding section was missing. And I sort of flicked back a few pages and there were the same pages again. And that really stopped me thinking about this book as, you know, a delivery system for words and got me thinking instead about actually this book is a material thing. You know, it's been manufactured in a factory and it's gone wrong. And that was really the first kind of time that I thought about the book as an object, as a thing, the real kind of the bookness of the book.
Yeah, so I wanted to ask a little bit about the codex, but first of all, just tell us what a codex is.
Yeah, so a codex is the book that we are familiar with now. Probably all the books that you've handled are codices. That's the plural of codex. And so it's a book with lots of pages stacked on top of one another and held together along one side by a spine.
So you can riffle through it.
You can riffle through it, you can move backwards and forwards, you can have kind of random access like you do with an encyclopedia, just open it up and plunge in, as well as sort of linear access where you start at the beginning and work through to the end.
Now, when did the codex first start? I mean, you say that it kind of took off between about 100 and 500 CE, just as Christianity was kind of gathering steam. But you also suggest that's no accident. What kind of reading do you think the Codex let Christians do?
That's right. I mean, it's interesting. And there's a famous moment in St. Augustine's Confessions where he hears the children outside his window saying, "Take it and read." And he picks up his Bible, his gospel, and he opens it to a passage and reads the words that kind of bring about his conversion. So there's a deep kind of affinity between Christianity and the Codex. And this is partly because they were emerging at the same time. The Codex appears right around the beginning of the Common Era. It's used for some Latin poetry, and it's praised at that point for being easy to access, easy to transport, small in size. But it's also early on is adopted by Christians. And if you look at the surviving records from the first 5 centuries of the Common Era, you see that books which are known to have been produced by Christians are more likely to be in the Codex form than books known to have been produced by non-Christians.
And is that because they were flicking backwards and forth to find the right bit of scripture or whatever?
Well, I think it's the two things emerge together, right? The Christians seem to have been early adopters of the Codex. They seem to have kind of developed the Codex as a technology. The format in which they were reading and the way in which they were reading kind of graft onto one
came
another.
Came together. I want to just sit back and think a little bit about the thingness of books just for a moment, because there's something slightly gauche about thinking of books as objects. I mean, think of all the scorn for Gwyneth Paltrow's book curator, the immaculately named Thatcher Wine. Is this partly because books are objects with a purpose? They're there to be read, so that thinking them as kind of things is neglecting that purpose.
Right, well, we often think that we actually want to get beyond the thingness of the book, that, you know, we want to not look at the book, but look through the book to the world of the author. And that's, you know, what reading is really about, is about getting lost in a book. And when you get lost in a book, the book itself gets lost as well, because you're looking through it rather than looking at it. And that's, I think that's kind of deeply embedded in Western culture, because it seems to me to kind of prop itself up on the opposition between the body and the soul, right? The book is to the body as the words are to the soul. And just as the soul can move from one incarnation to another, can transcend its fallible earthly body, so the text can move from one book to another, can leave behind the broken, dog-eared, coffee-stained paperback and move into some more, you know, beautiful
luxury
incarnation.
Leather edition.
Right, right.
I guess I'm just wondering as well, because the idea of something having a purpose is like halfway to something being almost alive. And is that, again, part of our emotional connection, is because we think they're kind of half alive, they're almost sort of people?
Well, it's interesting, isn't it, that people often, even if they don't necessarily think they're going to read a book all the way through again, they often hang on to it. Now, I heard a story once about a professor who came into class with a collected works of Shakespeare, and then he ripped it up and threw the pages around. And so there was a kind of miniature snowstorm of fragments of paper around him. And he did this because he wanted to suggest to the class that Shakespeare's plays aren't in the book, they're in They're somewhere else. They're in language, in the world of ideas. But actually, I think it was really the opposite, because the class were appalled. They gasped. They couldn't believe that he was doing this. And so that shows how much our reverence for authors, for literature, for words, for stories, for ideas gets transferred onto the material form in which those words and ideas circulate.
Now, you say that the Codex kind of was emerging around the around 100 to 500 CE, but it's, I mean, that puts it as a relatively new technology. I mean, how does it compare with scrolls or clay tablets or even a Kindle?
That's right. I mean, there were lots of different technologies that the book has made use of through time as it moves from being a clay tablet to being a scroll to being a codex to being the codex on parchment to being a codex on paper to being a hardback to being a paperback and so on, and now to being a Kindle or something that you read on your laptop or on your tablet. Looking at the history of that can really help us to think about how books relate to different technologies and how they navigate moments of media change like the one that we're living through at the moment.
Mm, yeah, I mean, one of the things that Jeff Bezos did when he invented the Kindle, when he set out to do that, was he explicitly wanted to mimic the Codex. He wanted to make it a bit like a book that you held in your hand. But despite all the kind of page-turning technology, isn't a Kindle a bit more, aren't e-books in general a bit more like scrolls?
It's interesting how technologies don't simply replace each other, right? It's not an on-off switch. It's not like there's one day in the past where print arrived and then everybody stopped using manuscript. Just like now, with the arrival of the Kindle, we haven't stopped using books. They continue to work alongside each other, but they do change one another's meanings, and they often kind of interestingly call back to earlier moments. So when you look at the first printed books, you can see how they're imitating manuscripts. Gutenberg, when he prints his famous Bible, one of the most important early printed books, he leaves space for coloured initials to be painted in afterwards. And the guys who are doing that are the people who've been working on illuminated manuscripts, you know, because that's where the expertise is. So he gets them. And so that's actually a kind of hybrid manuscript print technology being used there. So you can see all these ways in which new technologies become familiar partly by imitating or making use of or calling back to existing technologies.
I mean, you say that the Kindle is not only a book in some sense, it's also a bookshop and also a publishing house. But you say you only managed to get two cheers for digital publishing. Why only two?
I think that's right. Only two cheers for digital publishing, because there are lots of things that are changing when you change the format of the book. And what I'm trying to do in my book is not to sort of set up a kind of heavyweight title fight between e-books and printed books, but to think about what changes when the format of the book changes, and to get people to think about how printed books are so deeply embedded in our sense of ourselves, in our relationships, in our society, that when you change the format of the book, all of those things will change.
Yeah, we haven't even begun to mention audiobooks yet. Is an audiobook a proper book?
Is listening to an audiobook really reading? I had a student who had written an exam paper about Oscar Wilde's novel, The Picture of Dorian Gray. And the student wrote in the exam paper that he or she wasn't sure how to spell the name of one of the characters in that novel because they'd only listened to it and not read it. And at first I thought, this is outrageous. How dare this student write an exam answer on a book they haven't really read? All they've done is listen to it. But then I thought, well, you know, it actually, is that true? Is that, you know, apart from the fact they don't know how to spell this character's name, is the experience of listening to the book that different? And of course, there's a long history of listening to books that goes back well beyond the technology for recording them. Lots of people would have first consumed novels by hearing them read by other people, by members of their family, or, you know, in some cases in coffee houses or pubs and so on. So I thought, actually, you know, maybe that's just a different kind of reading. And I looked at the student's answer again and gave them a good mark.
Because actually, as it turned out, they had read it in some sense. I mean, I guess, your answer appears to be, forgive me if I'm putting words in your mouth, that there are all these different technologies, all these different formats, and they will coexist because they have different things that they do well.
They will coexist but they will also change each other, right? So you're now at this point where you can very easily get a book on your Kindle or on your laptop to now choose to buy the paper book, especially to choose to go into a bookshop and buy the paper book. That becomes a declaration of intent, a declaration that, you know, the default option doesn't necessarily suit you. And when printed books are the default option, it doesn't mean that in the same way, right? So a bit like going to buy a vinyl record now rather than downloading an MP3, you know, signals something about you, you know, that you demand something slightly different from your listening.
So, I mean, on this podcast, I think we're always most interested in what these changes, what effects these changes have on the books we get to read. So what do you think that's going to have as an effect on the texts?
I think it's interesting why we still keep producing new paper editions of texts that are now out of copyright and are freely available on the internet. And that really suggests ways in which the paper book might be adding value to those texts. And so it may be that we actually get the same things to read, but we get different experiences of them. And it may be that that ends up being a kind of form of cultural distinction that, you know, you make do with a text online, maybe, you know, formatted using optical character recognition software that contains some mistakes that you're happy to put up with because you're going to get a free text. I might, you know, go out and buy a hardback copy of the book with a lovely dust jacket and a ribbon page marker printed on beautiful thick paper and go and sit in my study and read it. And so that, you know, that might become a marker of cultural distinction.
Now, whilst we're in the study, I wonder if books en masse, books altogether, whether that has a different set of meanings than an individual book.
Yeah, this is something I'm really interested in, is the way that books gathered together in large numbers start to mean things that none of them individually say. And so, you know, I, as a professor of English literature, I spend quite a lot of time in huge research libraries, like the British Library just down the road from here. And there you see books gathered together in vast numbers, unimaginable numbers, far, far more than anybody could read in a lifetime, even if they did nothing but read. And that means that your experience of the book is changed in important ways, I think, that your absorption in a particular book is kind of shadowed by this sense of all the other books you could be reading and all the other books you'll never read. So books in large numbers mean different things.
But they can be straightforwardly intimidating.
Yes, and sometimes they're meant to be intimidating. So, you know, one of the things that big national libraries do is gather large numbers of books together in order to make the point that, you know, this is a learned nation. In the book I write about the Bibliothèque Nationale in Paris, which is a huge structure with four big towers, each at the four corners of the site, like open books. And that clearly is designed to materialise the knowledge of the nation and to make clear that, you know, the nation is a kind of intellectual powerhouse.
I guess writing and publishing, you say, is an attempt to ward off death, to save something of ourselves from oblivion. But couldn't it also be seen as an act of hope, investing time and treasure and energy in the idea that someone somewhere might want to pick it up and read it?
It is an act of hope, and an act of hope sometimes against the odds, because, you know, if you've been to a giant library, you think, well, you know, what are the chances in this enormous library that anybody in the future will encounter my book? But I do think to write a book is to imagine a time beyond your current moment when your book will be read. Now, you know, that might be next week or, you know, next year, perhaps. But it might also be, it at least opens up the possibility of it being in the distant future. And that's a really powerful motivation. But it's also something that reading does. Most of us spend most of our time reading modern books, books produced quite recently. But books are durable. They last for hundreds of years, if, you know, kept in relatively benign conditions. And so books also are a way of kind of unmooring us from our absorption in the present moment, giving us a better perspective and relativizing our kind of sense of being stuck in this particular time and place.
What about your own work? I mean, you're a writer yourself. Do you imagine a scholar calling up your secret life of books from the stacks in 500 years or 5,000 years.
What will that be like? I mean, will they get the book itself? Will they get an electronic version of it? How will they encounter it and what will they make of it? Of course, the odds are against this. The chances are that, you know, no one in the far distant future will read my book. But there will still be libraries in some form. There will still be readers in some form, whatever that means. And so there's always that possibility. And I find that quite a hopeful idea.
Tom Moll's The Secret Life of Books, Why They Are So Much More Than Just Words, is published by Elliott and Thompson. After the break, we're talking about an ancient poetry classic, Gilgamesh, and what it can teach us about engaging with remote cultures.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Welcome back to the Guardian Books podcast. The Epic of Gilgamesh is the story of a hero of Mesopotamian mythology. Gilgamesh is two-thirds divine and one-third mortal, a leader thought to have ruled between 2800 and 2500 BC. Gilgamesh is the oldest long-form literary work in history. For those who are unfamiliar with the story, Gilgamesh is sort of this godlike king, and he's really horrible. He sort of enslaves populations and habitually rapes all the brides of the men in his kingdom, and the gods decide that they need to create a rival in order to stop his bad behavior. And so they make a man from clay, and his name is Enkidu, and he later goes to fight Gilgamesh, and then they become friends because they have this fight and they sort of draw, but he sort of says to Gilgamesh, oh, you're amazing, and you know, we're a match for each other. So then they become friends and team up, and then the gods are unhappy with that, especially because they start killing a bunch of demigods. Enkidu is then he falls sick and dies, but he's basically killed by the gods, and the grief-stricken Gilgamesh sort of wanders around lamenting the loss of his friend and tries to basically find immortality.
Well, I'm very impressed by that, Shan.
Thank you.
Pretty much like Zeus, really, isn't it? Except
it is
without the immortality.
Bad behaving men that have a lot of power. And there have been a lot of translations of Gilgamesh, and some of them are different. And there's some things, like there's this 12th tablet of Gilgamesh, because they were all written on tablets and they all have different authors, and no one's really been able to identify who the authors are. And there's this 12th tablet where Enkidu comes back from the dead, and in some translations they say, oh, he's not back from the dead, it's just Gilgamesh had a son and called him Enkidu. So it sort of depends on who translated it, what version of the story you get.
So it's one of these things, stories that actually really, to have the life of a book. This is,
yes,
the life of a book, really.
Yeah,
isn't
exactly.
It? Not the book, but a book. And Michael Schmidt took this task up by asking 50 poets what the poem meant to them. It's one of those poems that every poet seems to have a view about. And he talks about, he goes back through the history of translations, including the 1960 classics version that I certainly, that was my first encounter with it, which it's become one of the biggest sellers for Penguin in terms of poetry ever, probably. And it sort of totally distorts it along colonial lines,
right.
As you know, then that's the fate of a classic, really, is always to be distorted along along the lines of whatever preoccupation the current climate has.
Yeah. And that was N.K. Sanders that did that translation, and there's this whole thing about, she introduced the pronoun I into the opening,
and that was just
because of the Odyssey.
Yeah,
basically she has this first person
perspective.
So, she was sort of domesticating it, because we all know, well, the people in her tradition all knew about the Odyssey, and so she was sort of trying to bring it within that tradition of epic, but actually it belongs to a far earlier and different tradition, and so part of what Michael Schmidt's trying to investigate is its differentness, and you know, which is not to say inaccessibility, but what it is that is not the same as we have always owned it to be. It has inspired a huge amount of popular culture, hasn't it?
Yes, including one episode of Futurama, which I love.
I was racking my brains. I watched loads of Futurama. I can't remember that episode. Maybe somebody listening to this podcast will be able to send me the clip.
And to Japanese rock music, which I was not expecting. But when Michael Schmidt came into the studio, Richard started by asking where he first encountered the poem and what he first made of it.
I first encountered it, at least in portions of it, at school when we were doing our Bible studies course. I remember finding the figure of Enkidu really beguiling. He was you know, the wild man, the green man, if you like. I found him very attractive. Gilgamesh himself always struck me, and still strikes me to some extent, as a spoilt brat, a grown-up spoilt brat, a monster kind of figure.
I'm wondering if writing your book has changed your reading of the poem.
As I wrote the book, I realized how integrated the story is, not in terms of narrative, but in terms of motif, if you like, you know, the continual repetition of certain numbers. I also sensed that there were changes in the characters. Obviously, Gilgamesh himself alters from being a horrible tyrant who enjoys first night rites with all the wives-to-be of his kingdom into this rather... still very aggressive and warlike, but this rather friend-obsessed protagonist. And then he becomes a very scared man as he realizes that he's going to die, and this fear of death begins to dominate all of his thinking. So there is a transformation. He is a character, not a person necessarily, but he is a character who evolves. And Enkidu remains a most attractive figure.
We're talking maybe versions a little bit. I wonder if you encountered it in the N.K. Sandars version.
Almost everyone who's read the poem has read the Sandars version. And they all have this sense that this is the actual version. In the Sandars version, Gilgamesh actually dies. And there are actual echoes of the Book of Common Prayer in the translation. And this is remote, couldn't be more remote from the original. She also doesn't observe the narrative structure of the poem. So she adds a great deal and subtracts a great deal.
Yeah, I promised we'd talk versions at some stage. I went out and bought Andrew George's version, and I'm trying to resist adding a translation from Bill Griffiths that tries to preserve the order and syntax of the original. Not to mention...
Griffiths is wonderful. It really is, because when you read a translation, you're often... The translator wants you to forget that you're reading a translation. But the whole point is the otherness of the culture it comes from should be something you always bear in mind. And Bill Griffiths is... very, very good at making the otherness apparent.
And what about Philip Terry's Dictator?
Well, I published that book, and I love it. I think it's very, very strange. He set himself two challenges. One was to remember its otherness by giving it a strange form. He divides it with musical bars every two syllables, so you're never able to actually even get a whole word. Without an interruption, if you like. But he also translates it into a language called Globish, which was invented to facilitate people learning business English. And only it's a very limited diction. I think it's 1,500 words. And there's no word for prostitute. So he has to call the Hieradule, the temple prostitute, a magazine girl. And it's very, very funny, these adaptations, this necessary adaptation of a limited language to a remote text. So it squeezes out the subjectivity of the translator.
You say Gilgamesh is vulnerable, impacted upon, commandeered, reread and misread.
Yes, I mean, there is a feminist reading of it, which foregrounds and, as it were, redeems the temple prostitute and the rather some of the rather weird goddesses that occur. You know, there is obviously an ecological reading of it. There's a colonial reading of it. I mean, there are lots of different ways of reading the poem, all of which the poem accepts. It's kind of a great receiver of these different views, but none of which is complete.
Exactly. And I mean, despite the poem's opening exhortations, in Andrew George's version, he suggests we should climb Uruk's wall, take the stairway, examine the brickwork. It's not even clear that Gilgamesh is coming out of an oral tradition at all.
Well, I think this is one of the assumptions that we make now, possibly because of the great scholarship of Lord and Perry, and the assumption that the Homeric poems began as oral poems. We assume, therefore, that all early poems are primitive in this that they come from a culture full of mnemonics. And in fact, there's no reason to assume that it was. It could have been a literary poem from the very beginning. My sense of it is that it is based on a number of disparate narratives which were brought together into this poem that we have. This curious redactor, Sinlechi Unini, sort of brought them together at some stage, but it is not a finished artifact. It's a wonderful amalgam, but I don't think it is a work in the way that, say, the Odyssey is, or indeed the Iliad, which also combine a lot of stories.
You suggest the poem, with its collection of praise poetry, prayers, debate, dialogue, diatribe, and of course lament, is better thought of as an anthology of genres. But isn't genre simply a later invention, a way of controlling readers' expectations that is only important in a world where there's a choice of what to read?
Yes, you're entirely right. And I think it may be the source, it may be the kind of fons et origo of genres rather than an anthology of them, yes. I probably expressed myself badly there.
Apology accepted.
the weirdest thing about the poem, I think, is that there's almost no concrete detail in it. I mean, there are lots of statements of measurement. There are lots of measurements of time, usually sevens and sixes. But there is, so that when, for example, the great ark is built to escape the flood, some people have thought that the ark was a boat shape. Some people have thought that it was cubic. I mean, Edwin Morgan, in his translation, makes it into a kind of giant, enormous Rubik cube. And then Irving Finkel, the most amusing of all the Assyriologists, I think, made it into a kind of circle, a kind of almost like a huge half bubble. And he actually built a model of this, and the model was filmed and filled it with all sorts of things, and proved that it would have floated. So there is nothing to. We can't actually get a very strong sense of the scale of Gilgamesh himself. You know, the measurements that we're given are epic and vast, but they don't really quite go together.
So, for those who don't already know, for the Gilgamesh scholars or the non-Gilgamesh scholars amongst us, what's the current state of play of the original text?
The original text is still not complete, obviously. I think most great Assyriologists hope that one day the full text will be extracted from the desert. It's come to us in many fragments from many different lands, from Turkey at the one extreme and from Iraq at the other extreme, and in different languages, different versions of Assyrian and different later languages. And so it has been a huge jigsaw puzzle to assemble what we now have, the 12 tablets. And every so often, well, more frequently than you might think, a new fragment is discovered which fills in one of the gaps. So it is like a vast scholarly jigsaw puzzle which has been put together over the years.
And they are literally fragments, like they're all shards, you might say. They're bits of clay.
Yes, they're bits of tablets. Since the book was written on tablets with a burin, they cut the cuneiform script into these tablets. And they must have worked at great speed. When you look at the tablets and feel them, there's wonderful texture about them. And there were many, many copies of the poem, clearly, in different times in different cultures. So but it was all done on clay. It was probably later on done on papyrus, but I suppose those have possibly perished.
To situate non-Gilgamesh scholars, what kind of time period are we talking?
Well, we're talking about a period probably that stretches from about probably 1200, 1400 BC right up to, well, even earlier, right up to the end of the Babylonian Empire. It's a very long period. It's about two millennia.
Yeah, you say that Gilgamesh belongs nowhere and it belongs everywhere, and you argue that we should approach the poem, if not on its own terms, which we cannot know with any certainty, then not on our terms either. But that kind of intrigues and worries me, because don't we always have to read from somewhere?
It's the only poem I know, apart from ballads, it's the only long poem I know where we cannot identify a speaker. There's no narrator, there's no I. So it's a poem without an author. It's a poem that, as it were, emerges from a culture. It's not a kind of primitive culture, it's a very, very sophisticated culture, given the nature of its structure, the nature of the mnemonics in the poem that you mentioned. It's not as though we're dealing with something primitive at all. We're dealing with something that is certainly equal to or superior to ourselves, not in technology, of course, but in composition, and we have nothing like it.
Michael Schmidt's Gilgamesh, The Life of a Poem, is published by Princeton University Press. Next week, we'll be talking about poetry again with Chris McCabe, Valjina Mort, and Vaughan Rapatahana. If you have any thoughts about this week's episode, do get in touch on Twitter, at Guardian Books, or on the podcast page. And please do subscribe and review us wherever you get your podcasts. But for now, from me, Sian Kane.
And me, Claire Armistead.
And our producer, Esther Opoku-Jenny, thank you for listening, and goodbye.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win. And support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.